right, it's recording. And it's been a long time since you've been on the show. It's been like, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years?
That's probably right. I think the last time I was on the show, we were talking about the exact same thing.
Get some new material, Jared. actually, that's something that I want to talk about because there is a kind of, you know, that we'll talk about that. Well, Jared, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you back. Long time listeners of the podcast will recognize you. Of course, your show is massive enough. Your show is much bigger than my show, I would say, too.
I don't know about that.
I don't know. It's hard to say.
It's been a couple of years since you've been on our show, too. So
it's true. That's true. That was a long time ago, too. I am excited to have you on. Jared, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about what you do. Tell us a little bit about the show you produce, Making Millennials or Killing Capitalism, just in case people don't know.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Tina. My name is Jared Ware. I'm co-host, producer of a podcast myself called Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. I'm also a journalist. Most of my journalism has revolved around prisoner organizing, which I know is one of the things that we'll be talking about today. And was part of the media relations team for the 2018 National Prison Strike. I guess that's enough.
Well, that's what we're here to talk about today, because there's a lot going on in the U.S. Carceral system, which is very large, as we know, the largest in the world by leaps and bounds. And we were saying this before we started recording, but it constitutes, I mean, we think of it as like, oh, it's prisons, right? Like, but it's like, it's not a really good way of thinking about it, because we just think of these, like we're thinking of the spaces, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to the institutions of carceration, of like incarceration, like the system of incarceration, and how it really is a sector of like the American economy and a large chunk, I would say, of the American world labor force that have these kind of exceptional status. Insofar as what they can be paid and whatever their lack of rights. So I wanted to kind of do a kind of macro explanation, because of course you did a couple of weeks ago, you did an episode of the show of what's God, the name is
Unauthorized Disclosures.
Yeah. With Kevin. And it's a great episode. I suggest everyone, maybe I'll link it in the episode description, because it'll be a kind of nice 1-2 combo. I don't want to go, you kind of lay out everything nicely in that episode, kind of what's going on. Maybe this episode, you can kind of fill us in, bring us up to speed with what's been happening since, and people who are interested in learning about like more the nuts and bolts of that, the kind of micro stuff, they could go and listen to that episode, and these kind of will work in tandem. That's kind of what I'm thinking for the shape of this conversation.
Yeah, that sounds good. And also, I will have a piece coming out on Prism Reports, not Prison Reports, but Prism Reports, probably next week. That'll be kind of a synopsis and sort of analysis of the whole strike. So, just keep an eye out for that as well.
Right. So, so just to bring us up to speed a little bit, can you tell us what happened? This started in end of September, right? 25th?
26th,
yep. Yeah. What's been happening?
So, yeah, on September 26th, a statewide strike started in Alabama. Alabama admitted, the Department of Corrections admitted on the first day that it was at all major facilities in the state of Alabama, which there's 14 facilities that they classify as major facilities. 17,000 prisoners in those facilities. And basically, by the state's own admission, and then also, of course, confirmed by prisoners that were involved all across the facilities, it started by people who had kitchen duty, which starts, I'm told, at like midnight, but certainly like very, very early in the morning on the 26th. they refused to go to their posts. And so that kicked off a whole chain of events, because prisoners do all of the cooking and cleaning in the facilities as one of their, you know, one of the jobs that they do. In Alabama, it is true, prison labor is completely unpaid. You know, so this started, and everybody refused to do their jobs. And, you know, it went on. It's possible. I'm hearing a little bit of mixed things about what's going on currently. The prison organizers that I've talked to have basically said that there's a pause going on right now, that they did this for about 3 weeks, and they're sort of regrouping, re-strategizing, you know, figuring out what they're going to do, what their next move is. But it's hard to overstate, like, how kind of remarkable this is for, like, 17,000 prisoners to refuse to do the work that runs the prison, including, and this had like a direct material impact on them, because then like the food gets really shitty, because, you know, one, the DOC doesn't want to give them, you know, is retaliating against them for striking. They cut the meals down from 3 to 2. They give them, you know, all kinds of gross stuff, right? And so they're trying to break the strike, essentially. So just the level of discipline and coordination, I think, is pretty remarkable in any context, but certainly within a prison. And I mean, I could say more about sort of the origin and history of this kind of strike action, you know, maybe now or later in the conversation. Now's fine. Yeah. So, I mean, the Free Alabama movement is a key part of this particular strike. They started leading strikes in Alabama in 2014. It's, you know, there's a few prisoners who are known within that movement. One is Kinetic Justice, who's been placed in solitary confinement in retaliation for this. He's been there many times before for retaliation for prisoner organizing. And, you know, they have a pretty sophisticated program in terms of political education. They work with street organizations. They teach history of like resistance and struggle. And, you know, they also have a set of sort of theorizing about the prison that sort of goes in a couple directions. One is sort of profiteering, which I have some issues with kind of academically, in terms of, I don't know that I agree totally with how they see it, but I think that in terms of their understanding of it as slavery, like, there's also no denying that forced unpaid labor in Alabama in basically death camps, right, is like, you know, like, we're really splitting hairs if we're trying to tell them that, like, that oh, you're not using an accurate descriptor of your own conditions right now. And so, you know, I guess I'll stop there for now. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I do think this is just the first phase of what we will see unfold, just based off of, I've talked to a couple prisoners who have been involved, and like, this has really, I think, raised their level of expectation in terms of what they feel like is possible. And I think that that's kind of a generalized sentiment across a lot of prisoners, of like, they're kind of impressed with what they were able to pull off. And their feeling right now is that that will continue to grow as a feeling and be played out again, and not that it'll like be totally repressed and go away. So we'll see.
Well, something I learned from your conversation with Kevin was that I guess is, you know, I guess maybe now that I think about it, I was like, well, that's not the most surprising thing, but, you know, the Alabama represents kind of the tip of the spear of the U.S. sort of industrial prison sort of project, the vast project. It is one of the, I think, the most like heavily, like in terms of the incarceration rate, it's according, at least to this, according to the Prison Policy Initiative, it's 938 per 100,000 people, which is, I think, the highest in the U.S. And you also said, which something which is really interesting, which I didn't know, this is also the, they did it like a decade and a half. They were ahead of the curve of three strikes laws, which is actually a euphemism for draconian, authoritarian, you know, like gulag approach to social policy, which is what the U.S. incarceration system is, right? It's a network of concentration camps that are heavily, heavily racialized, that represent a sector of the American labor force, right? And that's what I meant earlier. But when we say prisons or like even abolition, right? Like those are like concrete and like abstract nouns that like kind of are in the cluster of where we want to go. But we're talking about concentration camps. Like we're talking about like enclosed spaces where people in like vast numbers are held, and their like life force is channeled into either maintaining that space or some sort of like extracurricular, let's say, or extramural project outside of like the walls, right? Like California's famous, you know, firefighters, you know, like the firefighter class of people. You mean prison slaves that are sent into the fires? Yeah, you mean those people? Like this is this goes beyond. I feel like the words that we use and circulate fail us to really capture the scale of the U.S. industrial sort of incarceration system. This is kind of what we talked about in our episode a couple of years ago. However, the Alabama aspect of this, and it's obviously no coincidence that Alabama is a kind of the tip of the spear of this project, or kind of the more advanced or ahead of the curve, or however you want to call it. And it's also the site of, or the, at least in this case, the kind of advanced resistance, right? So like you think that there is a kind of historical interrelation between, you know, the most abused people in terms of numbers, like if you think about it that way, and versus the most like politically active in fighting that abuse. So there is a kind of like deep kind of political, historical kind of dialectic at play in this struggle that I think is really interesting. And, you know, the fact that like we're not just like clamoring to learn all we can from these struggles every day is so mind-boggling to me. I mean, we'll save that part of the conversation for later. But in the meantime, maybe we can think about what, maybe you could sort of tell us a little bit about what Alabama is inside of like the U.S. carceral system.
Yeah, that's a good question. So first I would say, I don't know that they have the highest rate. Like prison policy, it makes every state in some ways sometimes look like they have the highest rate. I think Oklahoma does for some reason. But
oh wow!
But the point that you're making, I think, is still accurate in terms of, and that may be true, but the general point about Alabama, you know, the habitual offender law, which is what they call their three strikes law, which was put in place in 1978. You know, when I saw that, I was like, you know, it's amazing because everybody thinks that three strikes law started 90s. Like 94, right?
Yeah, with California.
And you know, it is, if you read the law, like that's exactly what it is, right? It's like, if you get three felonies, you're going to wait for the rest of your life. Like that's what it is. And so that's one of the things, that's one of their demands, right? Their other demands are all connected to similar statutes, very racialized, like there's a drive-by shooting statute, right? Like obviously this is targeting a very specific person, right? In both people's imagination, right, but also like literally, and you know, I was talking to Garrett Felber about this because he also has prisoners that he talks to in Alabama, you know, and he was talking about how like in most states, the elders that you're trying to get out of prison have been in since like 1994. He's like, in Alabama, that's like everybody you encounter in prison, and that's. That's true to my experience as well. Obviously, there are plenty of people who are not in that boat, but I will say that like the movement is heavily led by folks who have like life without parole sentences or are doing 30, 40 year sentences, doing sentences so long that even if they're not technically life without parole, there's a very high likelihood that these people will die in prison, right?
Which is like one of the signatures of the U.S. incarceral system is that it has these like not life, but actually life sentences.
Right.
Like, yeah. There's so many options to do violence to people in the U.S. You can kill them. You could put them away like indeterminately. You could put them away for a determinate number, but that number is so high that it's effectively putting them away for life. Like, it's insane. They have every tool at their grasp.
Yeah, I think it was David Gilbert from, you know, formerly from like the Weather Underground and some other organizations, who's part of the Brinks, the famous Brinks heist, right? But I think he was in prison for 175 years was like what his sentence was. And he got clemency, you know, thankfully. But, you know, it was like one of those things. It was just like so absurd, right? Because it's like you're not even saying life. You're not even saying like, okay, you can have parole after 50 years or something like that. It's just like, no, like we'll put you in here for a sentence that's longer than a human lifespan, like, and just see what happens, you know? So I think the other thing to say about Alabama that is sort of exceptional, one, they're exceptionally bad prisons by the DOJ's standards, which I think are shit. And that's not a kind of framework that I use to like try to figure out, oh, well, what should we do? Like, but they, you know, the DOJ has been suing them for years about the state of their prisons, and their main issues the DOJ has is that they claim the state fails in its duty to protect prisoners from each other, essentially. And the DOJ also, like basically the level of violence within the prisons constitutes cruel and unusual punishment is what the way the DOJ says. And then also overcrowding. So this is the other thing that's been interesting a little bit with the strike, because people will see, I mean, because prisoners, there's cell phone video, like stuff circulating, people see stuff. And so people will see prisoners that are sitting in these big kind of like open spaces, and they're looking out the window and they're laughing at the COs that are picking up the trash, because now the COs have to pick up the trash, right? It's like kind of this wonderful moment, you know? You know, people are like, well, it looks like Kevin, I think, brought this up in the conversation. It looks like they can move around. And it's like, well, no, like it's like a gymnasium with 400 people in it. Like that's what being in prison, I mean, like obviously a highly surveilled and, you know, restrained, like you can't leave the gymnasium. But that is sort of like, it's literally like triple stacked bunk beds in a massive room with like 300 guys in it, you know? And so that's
it's a concentration camp. It's a concentration. Yeah, it is. It's a straight up concentration camp.
It's a straight up concentration camp. And even, you know, like I was talking to my friend Brooke Terpstra from Oakland Abolition and Solidarity. He's another organizer. And he's like, you know, in California, that's how it gets when things are really overcrowded and they have to create like special overthrow flow facilities or like an emergency situation. He's like, yeah, that's their standard like operation for the prisons in Alabama. And so that's another aspect of it. I'll say one more thing and then let you kick in a no question or whatever, but that there's been a push by Alabama to build new prisons. And I think one of the more interesting and important things is that the prisoners have been fighting against this for years. And so the prisoners understand that we don't actually need better prisons. We just need like an opportunity to get the hell out of here, basically, you know? And that's the thing that they want. They don't want like a nice shiny new facility where they could each have their own room or whatever, you know?
Yeah, no, I think this is something that I was definitely thinking about when I was listening to your episode, is that the, you know, we think of this like carceral machine, right? As this place that holds people back from their potential, which is like true. Like it's literally true, right? Like it's a tactic of keeping communities underdeveloped, obviously. Like if like a vast chunk of men of a certain generation, of a certain laboring class of people, like people who could, in theory, contribute to their community and like build, figuratively or literally, and if they're in a prison somewhere picking up garbage or fighting a fire somewhere, for the state, they can't build their communities, right? Like they can't help their families. They can't take their cousin to the airport for some whatever, right? Like you're extracting people from their families. So you just like, you know, that's like one real sort of aspect of it, is that it's about underdevelopment of certain classes and sectors of the American population. But it's also an industry, right? Like everything else in the US, it's an industry. So it's about like a kind of, you know, we talk about carbon capture. Like this is one of the biggest carbon captures, in the sense that you capture human life and you put it to use, either as like worker in like the in like keeping the institution alive or outside the institution, or as simply like using like the warmth of their body to like make profit in other sectors, right? So like, oh, the people who make money off the food, the people who make money off the soap, the people who make money off of like the actual human lives of these people and the maintenance of those lives. You know, I can't help but think, I mean, this is a perverse analogy, but in an old life, I was an academic and I wrote my thesis on the history of orphan institutions. Well, my first chapter was on the history of British orphan institutions. And I wrote on the kind of the world's first modern orphanage, and it was in London. And the building is still there. It's gone, long gone. We don't really have orphanages in that way anymore. We have kind of group homes. But the idea of like what it was and what was radical at the time is that it was a people factory, right? Like you put in these lost little children who had no parents, who probably would have died or probably would have been captured in like something. But then you put them in, teach them skills, and out come these British subjects, right? Like that was the thinking. Now, in reality, it didn't work out so well because a human life is expensive, right? A human life is very, very expensive. However, there was a project for 4 years in like the 1750s where there were so many like people dying, and there was like a fear of population. I think it was like a 7 years war or something. There was like a fear in England of not having enough population, right? So then they were like, let's fund this place. Let's everybody who comes, because until that point, they only had what was called selective reception. And selective reception meant that all the people who were coming to them, like all the poor people who were like, take my child, I can't raise him, mostly women, they would kind of look and say, ah, that one's kind of dirty. No thanks. Like, oh, that one has scabies. No, like we don't want to deal with that. And like, they would be selective and they would say, no, like we want the healthy ones. We want the clean ones, you know? And then they started this period of called the general reception with this panic, this kind of population panic, and Parliament funded it. Now it lasted 4 years and it was like a institutional disaster, in the sense that all of these human lives suddenly flooded, like suddenly arrived to this institution. They installed a kind of famous baby door, or kind of baby latch, where people could kind of anonymously give their kids, and you could kind of ring a bell and somebody would come and grab the kid, so you could be sure to know that like your kid was safe. At least your kid was received. But essentially though, is that like, what, at least this is my argument, is that like this was the kind of beginning of modern institutions, right? And like the way that modern institutions, even though there were kind of prisons back then too, and kind of workhouses, is that the idea of putting people into this structure, into this institution that are somehow misfits or somehow don't fit in, or antisocial is like the word that sociologists love, and then out come these new renewed beings who could be useful. I mean, this is the dream of capitalism, right? This is like, we need all the labor we can to make as much wealth as possible. And if we're letting these people die on the streets, it's not useful. Now, the American system is what's so genius about it, is that they capture as many human lives as possible. Like they go out and they have a general reception themselves, right? It's called the police. Like they go and round up anyone they can for any excuse, with any excuse, right? Like, and it depends on the context, depends where. Some places are worse than others, sure. But like, ultimately, the job of the police is to recruit people for these institutions, right? And it's recruitment. Police recruit to the like industrial, like labor machine called incarceration. right? And they are like the intake officers and like the social workers of these orphanages called prisons. But it's like there wasn't money being made off of the kids the way that the prisoners make money, right? These kids, the kids of the 18th century, would have cost them money, right? But there wasn't a capitalist industry that, like, for every part of their lives, right? Like, there wasn't, like, a tailor for them. Like, I mean, they had one, actually. But that was because they hired one. There were so many of them. Like, it was actually accidental communism. Like, it was actually, like, accidentally so they made communism for, like, 4 years. And then when they, like, got the bill, they were like, cancel this shit. 4 years is enough. I mean, it's a crazy story, and it's kind of forgotten. Anyways, that was a long way of saying is that, like, I have this, like, persistent sense that, like, we fully don't think of the prison system as a sector of the economy. Instead, we think of it as these spaces of exception where people lose their freedoms and they're racist and whatever and everything. But, like, I feel that that's, like, such, like, a simplification, and it, like, lets us down from, like, the sophistication of the prison machine. Because it's not, it, like, you could do it cheaper if you needed to do it. Like, you could do it and you could lose a lot less money and it would cost a lot less. But the point is the cost. The point is to extract value from that life that is ironically so valueless, right? In like the eye of like the average American, right? Like they're just forgotten, they're thrown away, whatever, right? Like, oh, felons, you know, like chased out of society, all that stuff. So it is a strange, strange contradiction whereby these people are considered to be like the lowest sector of American society. And in some ways, like they are a kind of subaltern class, and yet they generate so much wealth for people, right? I mean, that I feel is what is going to make abolition a huge obstacle, because there's a material, right? Like there's a material block to abolition, right? That like people are going to lose money. As you said, like the workers, like the institutions, all the people who feed them, like the, you know, the government cheese machine, right? Like the US government buys all this dairy, right? It's like one of the biggest buyers, and it's partly for prisons, right? That they resell to the federal, whatever, right? So that's, I kind of feel like I'm talking to the right person on this question, because this is your full-time job, that like, are we doing this right in our sophistication? Like, have we captured it?
So I think that I think abolitionist scholars really do the best work here. I think Ruthie Wilson Gilmore, you know, really does an excellent job. I think that, so there's so many things that come up with all of what you just said. I want to read your paper, first of all, but so couple things with that, with prison and labor, right? Is one, my argument at this point is not that prisoners are this massive profit producing labor force, right? My argument is typically that prisoners are what would constitute surplus labor, right? In a sort of Marxist sense, right? That just like we have whatever that jackass who works for the Fed keeps saying about we need to increase unemployment, right? In order to fix the economy. Like, this is part of that, right? Like, these are unemployed people in the sense that are not considered as unemployed, but are also doing labor, reproductive labor for the state. But the labor that they do, most of it is going into the carceral state itself. Like, okay, there are profiteering industries that come in, just like if you have schools, you're going to have Sodexo or Aramark or somebody that's going to sell meals to them. Same thing in prison. So people make billions of dollars. Like, I don't want to, but the amount that we spend as a society to put all these people away, like you say, it's expensive, right? In California, there's always this sort of like running headline every couple of years of like, we spend more on our prisoners than it costs to send a kid to Harvard, right? Like, that's sort of the joke in California. Now, California spends more than anybody else. Like, Alabama doesn't spend very much on its prisoners, right? And so the question is like, why, right? So I think that with that, there's a couple of answers. One is what you were talking about in terms of like targeting communities, like making them more vulnerable to the ravages of capitalism. When you take people out of a community, it means that the people that are left there, they have to work harder. They have to do more crappy jobs to make enough money. They now have to support their families, but they also have to support expenses that prisoners have a lot of times, right? Like, so there's a lot there. And I think the point you made too about community members is really important, right? Like, it's not to say that all of these people would be making like $100,000 a year out in the world if they were. It's to say, like, no, they could help their kid with their homework. They could drive their cousin to school. Like, they could, you know, mow the lawn. Like, you know, I mean, just all of the stuff that we all have to do. If you just imagine, you know, several of your family members being like taken out, how much more you have to take up, and how that pushes you to all sorts of living arrangements, some of which are interesting, and, you know, but so there's that element, right? There's that element of sort of, you know, what you could say is genocide, right? Like targeting a portion of a community and taking it away. And there's also then what you were alluding to, which is all of the jobs that are real jobs, that are state jobs, that are often very well paid jobs that are associated with this thing. And that goes from cops, which are typically very well paid as in comparison to other folks, you know, in wherever they are, right? And a lot of times people focus a lot on the police, and I think the police are incredibly important to this, but also, like, obviously corrections officers, obviously also you have to think about everybody who's involved in the court system in some way, right? Because unless we're talking about like civil court, or we're talking about, you know, like the two lawyers that go after like major companies or something like that, right? Like most of the system we're talking about, the criminal justice system, is just focused on like churning these people through the system. I mean, there's a thing that I think it's Prison Policy who does it, does a thing on churn every year. And it's like 11 million people that go in and out of the carceral system on a yearly basis. Like, so we have this understanding that like on any given point, there's like 2 million. But like, if you take that, about half of that is just in prison, like longer term. And about half of that is people that are just moving through jails all the time, right?
Yeah, it's every DUI, every jaywalking.
Yeah, like whatever. I mean,
whatever excuse they have. That's where the excuse to bring people into the system comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And it
recruitment.
And it. I mean, like if you look at like Ferguson, right? Like one of the things that the DOJ uncovered in their report about Ferguson was like fine farming, right? And like basically, like the city was just running off of giving people parking tickets, like giving like just whatever they could do. They were fining people for all of these little tiny things, like your taillights out, like everything was a fine. And then it became, you know, like people would get arrested after they didn't pay their, like it just became this thing and building up this debt to the city. And this was like subsidizing the city budget, right? I was arrested in New York in 2005. And when like a bogus arrest, and I don't want to go into the whole story, but like, the thing that was amazing about that experience was just that every person that I met, and this is not everybody who goes into the prison system by any means, but every person I met in that jail, it was like, what did you do? It was like, oh, well, I was barbecuing on the sidewalk. Like, you know, I slipped up and I was smoking a blunt and I walked right past a police officer. Like, it, you know, like, and like the people I saw get picked up, it was like harassing people on corners, right? Like that's what was going on. You know, it was like, you know, emptying their pockets and seeing if they could find something, you know, like it was that kind of shit. And, you know, like, I'm not saying policing, like you said, it's not the same every place and with every community, how it looks, but like, there's so much just like, and why do they do that, right? Because it's like, because their job is to churn people into the system. Like they have a quota for that night of like, okay, I got to bring five people back to me to come back to the before my shift's over kind of thing, you know? And so it's really like organized kidnapping, you know? And so then that feeds all of these other jobs, whether it's judges, DAs, assistant DAs, you know? I mean, you look at your local DA's office, you'll be amazed by how many people work for it, right? Like, so yeah, it's massive it works on an industrial scale, but the industry is like all of the things, all of the jobs that are like related to this thing, because, you know, my belief, right, is because like evil ruling class is like fuck those workers, like, you know, like we have to beat these people down, right, so that like, you know, they're not organized, they're not able to have community, and that's specifically targeted towards Black folks, to Native Americans, or I should say Indigenous folks, you know, to you know, Latinos, right? Like these are like specific populations, but it's also like a staggering amount of poor whites when you really look at it too.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the class warfare of our society, right? Yeah. And the prison machine is one of the key sort of like front lines of that war, right? Where you pluck out, like you pluck out the poor, you pluck out the disaffected, and you use them to help entrench your class interest by making the right people wealthier still, right? And ensuring, like we talked about earlier, that the poor people don't catch up, right? And so there's so many analogs to this, the kind of global international system you have, right? Of, say, like colonial states or imperial states in Europe in the 18th and 19th century, intentionally inherent, like, you know, underdeveloping their colonial holdings, right? To make sure to keep them down. I mean, like all these post 9/11 wars were about, you know, like setting back the clock. I mean, a lot of them people were like, oh, war for oil. Yeah, directly. But it's also about like keeping the enemies of Israel in such a state where they don't have enough electricity for like 4 hours of a day, right? So they can't help wage a war and, you know, possibly liberate Palestine. So like there's an underdevelopment aspect of the prison, of like the incarceral machine, that I think is so key. But to bring it back to Alabama, and I think this is the connection here, is that the size of the system, right? Because like the system requires such a mass of human beings to keep it profitable, right? Like you need more and more people. And then here's the like the flip side of that. It's like a double-edged sword, because the more people you bring to that system, the more people can possibly turn on you, right? That if they did manage to link up and to create a kind of class consciousness, which obviously they're doing at a large scale, then there's nothing you can do short of murdering thousands of people, right? I mean, I guess it has to escalate to that, right? You have to get to that point, right? And that does happen in the US actually often, right? You do have these actual prison uprisings and they're kept hush hush, and you know, they're not reported on. It's just like, you know, the lone gun people like you, like who just like pay attention to this stuff. But otherwise, it's a sector of society. It's like, no, go away. Like, don't talk about it. So on top of this like insanely violent genocidal machine that like enforces white supremacy, that has like evolved. People know this, but this prison system evolved from the slavery system, right? Of ensuring that, okay, well, we can't call them slaves now, so let's call them prisoners, right? Like it's the same capture machine though, of extracting free labor or nearly free labor from as many people as possible who are part of a class of people who are underclass, really. So like that element to me is really interesting. But then the moments like Alabama and this strike prove to you that it cuts both ways, because the more people you put in that system, the more sensitive it is to disruption, or to the kind of resistance that you would see. And this is something you brought up in your conversation with Kevin. Now with the advent of cell phones and smartphones in the last 20 years, right, that one of the principal tools of the incarceration system in terms of like keeping people broken from their communities is kind of like not as powerful as it once was. I mean, you know this better than I do. The role of these phones, has that led to, say, like more resistance? Have you seen more organization as tech has improved? Because you've been around doing this stuff for a long time. And I mean, we only got smartphones in what, 2006, 2007? So like, you know, that must be a whole thing, right? Because you can't, before that, you would have to smuggle a lot of stuff in it, you know, to get out, say, pictures, right?
Sure,
but now
yeah.
you can phone people live.
Right. So it's certainly like a big element. I don't know, you know, like the hard part is that there aren't a lot of sources, right, that really document prisoner resistance over time in like a really, you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah,
because
yeah.
of, you know, but like Perilous Chronicle, like they start with 2010 and, you know, the piece I'm going to write, I'm also going to start with 2010 and 2010 is important. It was the Georgia work strike. It was a strike that was coordinated across 8 prisons in Georgia. And it was coordinated with cell phones. And I don't know that it was the first prisoner resistance that was organized via cell phone, but it was sort of, that's the story, right, that was told about it. And that's the origin point for a lot of the consciousness of a lot of today's organizing prisoners, right, of, oh, like, you know, we, this is a tool that we can use to organize between facilities, to organize with our communities. And also it's a tool to have access to the media that's direct access. That's not, you know, if we're smart about it. And I think this, you know, well, I shouldn't say smart because that's making a judgment, but like, some people choose to be anonymous about this to avoid, to try to avoid repression from being a source inside. And some people are like, fuck it. Like, I don't care. Like, look at my face and hear my voice. Like, and the latter tend to face more severe repression, but also in some ways, paradoxically, right, are like some of the more inspiring figures within this movement. You know, I'd say Kinetic Justice in particular is one who has kind of always taken that approach of, and folks, a lot of the prisoners within Alabama do, of like no, like, put me on live, you know, and I'll talk to you about what's going on, you know, because I think they recognize the power of the visual and of like the spectacle and of like the real. Here you are, you're talking to a real human being here, and I'm going to tell you what's going on, right? And so that's kind of one aspect of what you're talking about. But certainly cell phones, you know, for one, they're a concern to the state. Like, so the, what is it, the FCC has like works, has done some pilot projects like in South Carolina with like cell phone blockers and like this stuff. And it is really interesting, right? Because the FCC had to create waivers for the prisons because you're not allowed in the United States to just like block cell phone signals, right? Like, because it could impact other people, right? There's like, I mean, I don't know all the law around this, right? But it's like, I guess ostensibly, like if you need to dial 911, right? Like, you know, there's protection for folks to be able to access the cell phone airwaves wherever they exist. And in theory, right, if you use cell phone blockers in a prison or around a prison, it could impact people beyond the prisoners, right? And so like they've tried to create different forms of blockers, like ones that can allow like the corrections officers to use their cell phones, but not other cell phones that aren't on the registry or whatever. Like, it's really kind of creepy and weird. But so it's a concern of the state that they're actually trying to figure out enough of like, how do we stop this actually? And I think I've always been concerned about that. Like, I used to not actually talk about the cell phones as much in my own work and reporting, because I was like, I don't want to expose like the methods that these folks are using to organize. But it's just so well known at this point that it's, you know, I mean, the New York Times talks about it. Like, it's not something that is actually a surprise to folks at this point. But it is an important aspect of the struggle. And in some systems, it's much harder to get a cell phone and much more expensive to get a cell phone, because to get a cell phone, you have to be able to get it from a guard. You know,
that's the other thing, right? Is that like the American system is so huge that it needs to recruit this labor force inside of the other labor force, right? Like, you need to have a guard system, and that guard system is sensitive to bribery. Like, a lot of different labor forces, like a lot of people want to take money. They're happy to take money. And like, you know, they become, I imagine there's a lot of, I imagine, social engineering that happens in the carceral system, where like prisoners kind of read their guards and say, oh, I could get somewhere with him, right? That like, oh, like this is something, you know. Now on the flip side of that, because of like the nature of American racism and like the nature of the scale of the carceral system, is that like the violence of it, like there's something that stayed with me to this day. I remember even when I read it, it was like some California prison newsletter. And I remember to this day that like they were kind of reporting on, you know, a prisoner had, you know, an incarcerated guy had attacked and seriously injured a guard. And they had like a picture of it. And essentially, you know, the memory of it is kind of hazy now, but essentially of it, it was a kind of like, we're going to lock him up forever, like kind of thing. And like, and I was thinking, and like, and I couldn't help but like, and there was like a picture of his face and everything. And, you know, obviously the guy had like nothing to lose in his current state, you know, so he like murders or almost murdered this prison guard. And I couldn't help but think that this man faces an incredibly short life. And when he dies, it will be called an accident and they'll laugh it off. And there will be no like inquiry into his death. No one will ask about it unless maybe a couple of his family members. They'll be stonewalled. And it's something to this day that stayed with me, that there are like millions of people whose lives can just be erased, you know, who have been erased socially speaking, and they can just be literally erased because the US prison system is so violent and it's so cruel, and you're in it. So many people are in it for so many years that you can't help but think that, of course, there's sometimes your families, you lose touch with your families, that it only ends up, you know, that if I were to disappear inside that system, no one would miss me, right? And like, to this day, I still think of that. And it's still like, it was like a big boy moment where I was like, wow, the world is a cold, mean place, you know, like, and it's a cruel place full of like terror that like this exists. And like, you know, I was in California and I was like enjoying LA, whatever. And like, you know, but like, this is millions of people share this experience, like millions, actual millions, you know. And, you know, the other thing, and the darker thing, is that we have this tendency, and this just happened in Iran, for instance, that we get really, really excited, because mostly our media tells us to, that we get really, really excited about acts of rebellion and revolt in other countries, right? That we can't help ourselves. Now, in the case of Iran and whatever that country may be, there's usually a reason for that, right? Like there's usually a reason. It's not because of humanitarian, obviously, but there's a kind of geopolitical reason. And I can't help but think that there are millions of liberals inside the United States and whatever in the West, in the settler colonial West, who have this kind of like, you know, in their hearts, they have this immense sympathy for, say, someone in an Iranian prison or someone in a Syrian prison, right? They have this, at least in their heads, they think, oh, it's so terrible. It must be really terrible. And yet the far more advanced, the far larger, far more brutal, right? Just by every metric, right? System that they themselves fund, right? That they themselves are paying for, that they profit from indirectly, in the sense that, oh, California prison, like whenever there's like a fire, like some wave of fires, California taxpayers don't have to pay $40, $50, $80 an hour. They have to pay $3 an hour, right? Like that benefits you. That benefited me, right? Like that made that material benefit paid dividends to me. I didn't know it. I didn't see it. I didn't see it directly, but it paid like, you know, directly to me, in the sense that like the wealth generated came back to me because I'm part of a class of people who benefits from, right? Who doesn't get incorporated into that wealth system, right? Of that prison system. So I can't help but think that like, you know, that thing will still be with me to this day, that like this violent, violent machine where human lives are erased every day, that like are never mourned either, right? Like nobody ever mourns them. There's like a tiny industry of people who like pay attention, tiny, like we're talking a few thousand in a country of 300 million, right? And who are responsible for an incarceration system that, as you said, like 2 million, right? Like it's more than 2 million probably, that like, you know, if you include the jails and the juvenile system and the group homes and everything, right? We're talking probably over 10 million, right? That like that to me is one of the profound, profound pathologies of our moment, right? That like us in our oh so like, you know, like human rights loving worldview that like the violence done to this huge number of people of your own country is just erased and is written off as like, oh, it's normal. Right. Whereas the violence in other countries that they dare to have prisons too is somehow, you know, unconscionable. Oh my God, get amnesty. What are we going to do? Let's, you know, Juliette Binoche is cutting off her hair on Instagram. Like, oh my God, you know, like, come on, man. Like, what the fuck is wrong with us? Like, why can't we see these people? Is it just racism? I mean, a big answer is yes, it's just racism, but like, but it's something else. It's something else. It has to be something deeper.
Yeah. I mean, one aspect, right, is actually, this is where folks, if they want, should also go back to our prior conversation, because this was more the central theme of that, right, which was like that the human rights apparatus in the United States and the Western world is an outward facing apparatus, right? It doesn't examine it, you know, our own countries are not examined. And occasionally, every once in a while, there'll be a report, right? Or there'll be like some acknowledgement of something on a small scale just to kind of keep up some sort of mystique, right? Of objectivity, which is bullshit, right? But yeah, I mean, I think that in general, right, we demonize other regimes around the world, you know, we demonize other countries. And that is largely for the purposes, you know, of imperialism, of monopoly capitalism, and of those interests. And, you know, we don't have, you know, the benefit of the Cold War and of like Soviets to there's not some other force in the world that is pointing out all the contradictions of the United States and saying like, hey, you guys still are segregated, like what the fuck are you talking about, right? Like, you know, land of the free, like what are you talking about? People can't vote in the South, like what, black people can't, you know, like, so, you know, this is, I think, in some ways a consequence of, you know, what has been at least a a unipolar world for a number of years. Hopefully we're moving towards something closer to multipolarity, but, you know, the US has certainly done a great job in the last, you know, 40, 50 years of, exceptionalizing itself, you know, with regards to these issues. I think that, I don't think nobody cares. So I think that, you know, when you think about like the statistic they always use is that 70 million people have had a felony conviction or whatever. And it can't just be that because they've been saying that for like 20 years now. So it has to be much more than that. Yeah. But the, you know, this is a huge section of the population that is aware of this. And actually, the folks that I see doing the most interesting and kind of dynamic organizing around that are prisoner organizations, like folks like Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, you know, who have had a platform on the right to vote for incarcerated folks, including like formerly incarcerated folks, because this is also an issue, is that vote, you know, there's real voter disenfranchisement that's associated with this. You know, and so there are issues that matter, particularly to the communities that these folks are extracted from. And I think part of it is that neither party, right, they're both in on the con, so they don't talk about it at all, right? So it's like the Democrats love the cops even more than the Republicans do, if we want to be honest. Like, and so there's not a there's not one of the bourgeois political parties that's willing to address this at all within political discourse. Bernie actually probably came closest in 2020. And that was interesting because he was partly influenced by the prison strike and by the platform. He actually spoke. He actually had people reach out and talk to the organizers of that prison strike. So that was kind of an interesting, you know, development in some sense. His platform still was not great, in my opinion, but it did at least start to speak to some of the issues that were being raised. But yeah, I mean, we don't have any media out there that's like really like anything that focuses on prisons in the media is weird shit. It's like,
yeah, it's voyeuristic.
It's voyeuristic. It's yeah. like reality TV inflected. Yeah, it's
awful.
Like,
it's such awful shit, man.
You know, and so,
I mean, that's one of the parasitic aspects of it is that, like, you erect this incredibly violent, genocidal, incarceration machine, and then you like fill it with 1,000 cameras for entertainment. I mean, that's the scale of the evil we're talking about here in the United States.
Yeah,
like,
actually,
that's the pathology that it's like sport. I mean, there's like a whole, what's the border security? There's every aspect of our police is extracted for entertainment too. I mean, cops ran for 30 years or something like that. Yeah. And it was just a way to like catch poor people in their like most vulnerable, terrible state.
I think it's still running because I think it got like canceled and then like some right wing like group was like, no, like we have to keep this and like picked it up.
Oh my God,
and,
it's true. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, because that's the thing. Prisons are also been incorporated into like the culture war machine of the US too. So that's why you get those like 300 year sentences because the judge who's like voted in by like these cranks in whatever. Right. Like they use that to market themselves as, you know, TUFF on crime. Right. Like Joe Arpaio. Right. Like it's
like I just on that point quickly. I mean, I'm in Pennsylvania, so I'm seeing it play out right in the like local election here right now. I mean, John Fetterman, who's running for Senate against Dr. Oz. I mean, fuck this society, man. Like, what the hell?
Dr. Oz. Futurama ass timeline.
So, but anyways, like the main point of attack against Fetterman is like that he opposed the felony murder statute, which the felony murder statute says, like, if you and me go to 7-Eleven and I shoot the cashier, that you're going to prison for the rest of your life. That's what felony murder is, right? And so, you know, like it's not me, it's you, right? And so he said that this was terrible and that everybody who was under that statute should be released, right? And so they you know, the commercials are like, John Fetterman wants to release child rapists to shoot your children. Like, you know, it's like that kind of shit, you know, and paid for by Dr. Oz. And in Alabama, there's this lady, the governor, her name is Kay Ivey. And like on the first day of the strike, this was really interesting because she acknowledged it on the first day, which like I've never seen that. Like, I haven't been following this forever, but, you know, 10 years looking at this shit, I've never seen a governor ever acknowledge a prison strike. But I've also, you know, usually the DOC, often it's hard to get them to acknowledge anything. Like they'll say, oh, you know, there's a security concern, maybe. Like they'll say something like very, you know, Orwellian and nebulous. But she acknowledged it in order to say their demands are ridiculous and that we will never allow like murderers and child rapists to walk the street. And that's what these people want. Like that was her. And she was like, we prioritize public safety in this state. You know, in Alabama, that's what we care about, right? And so you can see there, right, like that's the other side of it is, you know, in Alabama they're like, well, this Yankee DOJ, right, wants to sue us and say that our prisons are inhumane, but we don't really care. Like, we care about keeping these thugs off
the
street.
We like that,
right?
We're proud of that fact, you know.
And I use thugs in air quotes, but that's what they think, right? But yeah, I mean, so those politics definitely play out in terms of like who can be tougher, you know, on crime.
I mean, that's a big
and,
way Trump won.
Yeah.
It was like his, you know, that kind of chud aspect of the kind of lizard brain aspect of like American white supremacy, you know, that it just, it has a strange, like, you know, kind of like double movement against itself. Like on the one hand, you have this fetishization of the unlimited freedom of the individual, right? To consume and go and do whatever. I mean, in terms of where you're not, you know, entrenching on the rights of private property, that like my own personal private personhood is so sacred. But on the other hand, you have this other thing called white supremacy, right? Which says the opposite. It says, no, your life is meaningless. And if you don't count as white, and so your individualhood is actually really, I can just erase it at any time, right? And we can celebrate it, right? And so all those cops that kill people on a daily basis in the US, right? I mean, this is also like, and I think this is something that people who've never lived in the US don't really know, for like people who listen to this, who've never been to the US, who never lived there, is that it's not a country. Right, it's a continent. It's a continent of people, right? And then it's broken up into these states, and each of those states have its own unique history, like cultural and political and economic, like conditions, and inside of those have like the racial conditions of those are set and attenuated to those, that white supremacy behaves in a certain way that's attenuated. So white supremacy behaves in a certain way in Alaska that it doesn't in, say, Louisiana, right? Like it doesn't have, like, say, like the problem of blackness in Alaska. I mean, I'm sure it does in its own way, but let's say for whatever reason that its racial problem is indigenous people, right? That, like, you know, or in California that it's a, you know, that it's brown and blackness, right? I mean, I guess that's true for most of the US, I imagine, by now, that like it's white supremacy has kind of like expanded its scope. But like, because of its fictionality as a country, you then have these things called states that then can enact their own ideological uniqueness through prisoners, that prisons become a way to express your political identity, your stance on prisons, your stance on this, right? So it's not just that it's like a bulwark or like a pillar of like the American like economy and like labor, right? Like the national economy as a whole, that it's actually like an important mechanism that, say, political and religious and institutional and, say, educational and just like the state itself, that it can then use the prison as a site of like articulation of itself, that it can like imagine itself in a certain way. So like, a you know, Joe Arpaio, for people who don't know, he's like, you know, like, I mean, I don't even know how you describe Joe Arpaio. He's Arizona sheriff, right? I mean, even the name sheriff is insulting, because we're supposed to go along with like the American fascination with itself, and that it's of its own sort of settler colonialhood. So it's not good enough to just call him a cop, you have to call him a sheriff. But like that, like you have to perform this, like that politics is so effective that it works to create such a class consciousness, and that class consciousness is racial first and foremost, right? That like poor white people can vote for Joe Arpaio, even though it's not in their interests materially, it is in their interest racially, in the sense that class, like race, white supremacy is the strongest form of class consciousness in the US. And that's where the prison system isn't just the kind of economic system, that it's like a kind of historical kind of class identity system that helps, or sociology, let's say, that it's like a sociology machine, right? That kind of keeps everything in its right place, that people belong there who are like who look like that, and people who belong there look like that, and never the twain shall meet, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on what you just said. I mean, for one, the point you made about states articulating themselves individually and having their own political identity and seeing that play out in the prison, and also like the prison as a kind of, you know, I don't know what the word, incubator of that, or like, you know, petri dish of that, or site of experimentation for that. I think that that is absolutely true. And I think it's also, you know, we've seen a couple attempts at doing a national prison strike. It's always interesting to see who participates and where they don't, how many prisoners in different places, et cetera. You know, it's very interesting. People participate in different places. The South always has more participation in what I've seen, you know, and I think there's a very clear understanding. Like I said, with Alabama, like, I've never really been able to convince a politicized prisoner in the South that talking about prison in terms of slavery was the wrong approach. And I've tried, because I think that there's limits to it in a certain way, in terms of, like, Ruth Wilson Gilmore talks about the problem of innocence. And she talks about how slavery appeals to people in thinking about the prison, because it allows us to imagine that everybody that's in prison is innocent, and they're just for, like, bad reasons, just to make profit off of them, right? And I think that she's right. I think that that's actually a flawed understanding, you know? I think it's deeper than that. And I think that, but you can't, you really have a hard time arguing that with a prisoner in the South that's, like, in a prison that's, like, you know, my prison's 85, 90% black. We're not paid. We do all of the work for this thing.
Yeah,
you know,
like, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it might be a duck.
Yeah. Well, and so it's like, so I don't, you know, I've had a lot of discussion with it, and I think that there's reasons why, of course, that resonates. I also think analytically it's pretty sound in terms of how they look at it from that point of view. And I think it obviously is useful for them in terms of how they discuss it with their peers. My concern is always sort of like, do you get too hung up in this discussion of profit, right? Do you think that then you resist in a certain way and you can stop the profit, or you change certain laws and then, you know, suddenly because it costs more, they're going to let you out? And I don't think that that's the case, personally. I think that the state is willing to spend a lot of money to keep people locked up. Because I think it's so important to the kind of political identity,
yes,
like you're talking about. And so, to the point about, like, white supremacy and, like, how it articulates in different areas, I mean, it's very interesting, you know. And I think that obviously prison systems are always racialized, right? They're always, you know, it's like, what is the true racial composition of class, right? Like, that's what you're looking at, right? Like, this is working class, this is lower class, this is poor, right? And so there are always white people in them, you know? And I think that's another reason why it's important to, like, sort of grapple with this even a little more, right? Because it's like, okay, so we can say all the, you know, we can obviously see racism and all the overrepresentation of Black people, of Indigenous people, of Latino people, of other racialized people within them. But then it's always this question of, like, so why don't white people care that there are, you know, 800,000 of the, you know, other white people that are locked up in this thing? And I think, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about this. And Brooke, who I mentioned earlier, is somebody I think about it with. And I, you know, I think it's, like, really, it's deep. I mean, in some ways, there's this thing about, you go all the way back into, like, Europe. There's this idea of usufruct, which is, like, you can own a piece of land as long as you improve the use of that land. And if you don't, then it gets taken away from you, right? This is also, like, how, like, sort of the liberals think about self-possession, being a self-possessed human being. You're a human being as long as you're improving yourself and making use of yourself through our own, like, white supremacist logic. And so the white people who go to prison, in my mind, are the sort of fallen among white people. They're the people who are not properly improving themselves according to the sort of white supremacist settler logic. And I think about this too, because I've known a number of white people who have family inside, and, like, it's never a sense of, oh, an injustice was done to them. It's a sense of, they didn't, you know, they're not, they didn't fulfill their, like, duty. Like, they've fallen. Like, there's, you know, they're ashamed of their white relatives that are inside, right? And it's different from, I think there's a sense of shame that can often come with incarceration because it's stigmatized and everything else. But, like, this is different. This is like, no, I'm ashamed of him. Like, I, you know, my child did not turn out to be what I wanted him to be, kind of thing, you know, not that the state kidnapped my child for doing something stupid, you know? And so, yeah, I think that's an element of it too. And I think about that a lot because I grew up in Southern Oregon, right? And like, the, you know, like the opioid epidemic, meth, like all that shit, like hit that area hard. And I'll go back there and I'll see people I went to school with, right? Who have been caught up, who've been, you know, who are staying in like these tweaker motels, as we call them. And, you know, it's like, and like when I worked there for 5 years later in my life, my colleagues would always refer to these people as tweakers, as zombies, as, you know, and it was like, there was no sense of community. There was no like, oh, like, yeah, I went to school with Austin. Like, that sucks. You know, it was like
junkie.
It was like there's something wrong with these people. Like they're animals. It's a subhuman kind of thing, you know.
But that's also a product of something very specific and very intentionally designed, which was the drug war, right? Like the 80s drug war, which was a recruitment drive. It was a recruitment drive for prisons, right? It wasn't like, and that's what I mean about like we think of these things wrong, is that we're thinking of them kind of backwards, is that we think of it as, oh, they did a drug war and these are the casualties. It's like, no, they did a recruitment drive and the drugs were the excuse. Like it was the pretext, right? It was the excuse they needed. So like the fact that like, you know, crack had all those like extra like enhanced whatever they're called,
enhanced sentencing,
the
sentencing disparity was like 500 to 1 or something
like that, because you know, because that's white supremacy working its way. But that's a way of also like speeding up the production of, or like the recruitment of, this class of people called prisoners, right? And so I'm rapidly coming, I'm kind of like returning to my Marxist roots, I find, because it's funny, I came into thinking about prisons through anarchism, and actually it was like some pivotal kind of moments in my life of, you know, like sort of thinking about what prisons were. And I think obviously anarchists have probably done the best job as a kind of group of people of talking about prisons. It's actually one of the things that they excel at, I would say.
I would agree. I mean, most of the folks that like I've, you know, organized with or talked with or, you know, been in community with around this stuff, like a lot of the folks on the outside, whether they use the term anarchism or not, like they come from that sort of tradition largely.
Yeah. And it's a useful way, because you see it, because it helps you kind of like, at least the anarchists are like obsessed with like the state, right, as this kind of like overarching enemy to their thinking of like, or to their worldview. It's like kind of the antithesis to their worldview, which is why they very correctly latch onto the prison, because that's one of the most powerful manifestations of the state. That's like one of the most advanced places of any state is its prison apparatus. Like we don't think of it. We think of like, oh, these decrepit places, but no, that's on purpose. Like it's intentional that they're shitty, that like human lives mean nothing to them. But that's like the effect, though, is that like this is where the state imagines itself. This is where it gets to be its most stately, so to speak, is that in making these spaces and creating this, and then also fussing over them. Be like, oh, what are we doing? Are we getting enough calories into these people? Maybe they should learn to read books. Like, you know, and then the hand-wringing of the liberal class comes in. It was like, you know, and this whole apparatus kicks in, right? And then there's like the religious aspect, right? We haven't even talked about that. All the churches, all the pastors, all the programs that get fast-tracked, like the ways that people can get out. I mean, actually, you know, have you guys done an episode on Clockwork Orange?
No.
You know, because I mean, that was something that like, oh, I guess stuck with me early about like what the dream of making a subject, because of course the goal was to make him a cop, right?
Right. I mean it's the whole thing about experimentation within prisons is like just a fascinating field to itself. I mean, prisons were initially an experiment, right? And it was like originally, like at least in the United States, like penitentiaries, right? Like the term comes from penitence, right? It was a like religious, like Quaker kind of movement, which is just fascinating because everybody always thinks of the Quakers associated with like social justice and everything like that, peace, right? And Like, they just thought, like, oh, if we put people alone in a room and, like, give them time to think, right? Like, they'll figure out what's wrong with their lives. And, like, you know, it's like, no, you invented a form of torture. Like, you know, like, and they realized that, like, that was realized in the 19th century. Like, people realized in the 19th century that solitary confinement was torture. And then they were like, oh, we need to do more of that. We need to figure out, like, an advanced form of that, you know? And yeah, I mean, you know, I've been working on a project with Orisanmi Burton. I don't know if it'll come to light at any point, but it's been a lot of fun to talk about it with him and stuff like that. And like, there's all kinds of wild stuff within prisons, because it's like, you have CIA experiments that have gone on in prisons. You have, like, you know, I mean, like, drug experimentation that's gone on, skin experimentation. I mean, all of the things, like, you know, like, we talk about
all the things we imagine Nazis doing, they do in the US.
Yes. And some of the people who did them were Nazis, right? That were like, actual Nazis, right? I mean, they were all fascists, right? But like, some of them were like, hey, this guy.
Kleenex versus napkin.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, there's a ton there that folks could, you know, dig into and do more work around and all of that. But yeah.
Jared, it's been over an hour. I should probably let you go. I know you're a dedicated family man. We should think about wrapping it up and kind of global. I mean, I'm not gonna. I know you've answered this question already in your episode with Kevin, so I'm not gonna make you do it again. But like, if you were gonna have a recruitment drive for like abolition movement. Like, how do you think would be the most effective? If I gave you like a big budget, like, how do you think you could evangelize the world with abolitionism?
Whew, that's a good question. I don't know that I didn't answer that question.
The last question was kind of like, how could we help people there?
Yeah. Well, so I do think folks should pay attention. There's a group called Both Sides of the Wall that's there. You can follow Free Alabama Movement on Twitter. So like, you should pay attention, and there are sometimes calls for how you can support. Right now, there's not anything that's being asked, but if you follow those sources, you can kind of see, you know, stay up to date. Also follow Jailhouse Lawyers Speak for sure. They're a good prisoner organization. So to recruitment for abolition, I mean, there are certain ways in which abolition has had a big moment in the last couple of years, right? And a lot of it has to do with the rebellions after George Floyd and it being kind of popularized, the connection with the defund campaign. And so there's that going on, you know. And I guess what I would say is, I think that's an important aspect. And I would say to folks, like, if you look at social movements in the United States, like, a lot of them are associated with abolition and with policing, and but that it's mainly been policing in the last, you know, 10 years, whatever. And it's interesting because the prison is often neglected and prisoners are often neglected. And, you know, like, I don't encourage people to valorize, or like, I'm not somebody who's like, oh, the prisoners are the perfect revolutionary subject. Like, I don't think that, you know, it's not been my experience. But they are people there that, you know, often crave human connection that you can build relationships with. I think there's a lot of good work that's done, you know, sending books in and out, like communicating, writing letters. You know, I think that as far as the drive to abolition, like, what I want abolition to be is a revolutionary movement, right? Like, I'm not really interested in the abolition that's sort of like, oh, if we make these little tweaks and I don't think that's an unfair characterization of abolition, because I think most of the people who talk about things like non-reformist reforms, they're just sort of talking about a test that you can take on a reform to say, like, is this good or bad? Like, are we actually rooting for something that's against us, right? And I think that's an important thing to think about whenever you're struggling around some sort of political demand. But, you know, the reality is, like, the world that abolitionists want is a totally different society. Like, it is, you know, Ruth Wilson Gilmore will say it's, like, as close to, like, it's small C communism, right? Like, it's, again, it comes back to, like, what's the difference between, you know, anarchism, small C communism, full communism, like this. The debates often are about how do we get there, right? Like, what's the, you know, do we have to build up this state in order to do this, right? And I think that what abolition gives folks is a framework to struggle around issues right now and to try to do it in a way where you're treating people well and you're attending to all of the things that you would hope that that society that you want, that ideal society, is attending to. And the reality is, like, we live in a shitty capitalist society, so you're gonna face, like, all of these contradictions, all of these issues, but at least you'll be there with folks that are, like, building a sense of radical community with each other and trying to be better humans with each other along the fight. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's probably my best elevator pitch, not expecting to have to give an elevator pitch on abolition.
Jared, thank you very much. This is a lot of fun.
All right. I appreciate it. We're going to get together and we're going to talk about Carlos soon, which was,
yes,
what we were supposed to do.
It's true.
But I think we're going to do a movie conversation on it, which will be easier than us trying to freaking do a whole academic discourse on it.
People are like, which Carlos? Like, yeah. Carlos Ramirez from upstate New York? Not that Carlos.
Carlos the Jackal. Yeah.
Yes. We're going to do a terrorism episode. It's, yeah, going to be fun.
Yeah.
If I wasn't on any list before, I certainly will be after. Oh, thank you, Jerry. This is a lot of fun.
Thank
I really
you,
appreciate your time.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.